Hello and welcome to Volume 29 of Capital Ideas Live. In this issue, we'll talk about carbon storage, also what's going on in Washington and Montgomery. We'll talk about managing your forests, managing your relationships, and we'll check into what's new in the stumpage prices. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. This is something you already know. Forests are highly favored for their properties in protecting soil. The CRP program has actually recognized this and has paid landowners to plant trees. But there's another benefit of forest land to the environment about which you might not have known, and that's its ability to store carbon. It's called carbon sequestration, and it's recognized by various governments in helping to limit things like global warming and the greenhouse effect. Jim Cathcart with the Oregon Department of Forestry is with us to give us a window into the carbon storage world. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Welcome.
Jim, if you can store carbon, you have what I hear is called something called a carbon credit. Could you tell us what a carbon credit is and why people are interested in buying them?
Yeah, a carbon dioxide emission offset or credit is a transferable certificate or agreement that documents a measured amount of carbon storage from adopting a practice or project such as planting trees or getting people to use less gasoline or adopting less tillage in agriculture, practices that improve carbon storage. In the United States, business and energy sector interest in carbon offsets is voluntary. Test wells, if you will. The interest has evolved from one of goodwill and public relations to more of a commitment to a voluntary cap and trade system such as the Chicago Climate Exchange. Some states like Oregon have adopted carbon dioxide emission standards for new power plants. Internationally, many countries have adopted the Kyoto Protocol, requiring them to meet carbon dioxide emission limits during the 2008-2012 period, and carbon credits is one mechanism of that protocol.
Okay, so a credit sounds like a transferable object that can be exchanged between people.
Correct.
And it's somehow quantified. Well, why is the interest in trees, though?
Well, forests naturally sequester carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and they store this carbon in live and dead matter in the trees themselves and downed wood, in the wood products that we use from the forest and forest litter and soil. And the factory is photosynthesis, the process plants use to make food using carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and energy from the sun.
Okay. If you're fortunate enough to have carbon in the form of trees, how does one go about actually getting paid for storing this carbon for other people?
Well, right now the markets are speculative. I'm not aware of any direct payments to private landowners for the beneficial services their forests provide with respect to carbon storage, though this is certainly a direction we'd like to see the emission markets go in. Right now I'd characterize the market as being project-based. For example, I manage a pot of carbon dioxide emission money for a power plant here in Oregon, and that money is used to create new forests on private lands. The landowners benefit indirectly. We pay all the reforestation costs with no requirement to pay back the monies unless the landowner profits from future timber sales. But as the forest grows, we measure and calculate the carbon credit and pass it on to the power plant. The landowner gets the forest in full control over its use. What we like to do is caution, you know, just like with any commodity from a forest, be it timber, recreation leases, mushrooms, or carbon credit, landowners need to research their understanding of the market and the pricing terms before entering into any agreements. Seek references and get to know your buyer. I would caution landowners not to enter into any agreements that require them to put up their own money or a commitment to do something at their expense into the deal and kind of in hopes that the money, the carbon money might come later. I'd rather, seek agreements that are consistent with your practices that you want to undertake but may currently not afford. In this regard, a forest management plan for your property really can prove instrumental in understanding your needs, but, you know, my my message is that use the value of carbon credits as a means to a desired end, not an end in and of itself.
Okay. Well, thanks, Jim. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Well, our next guest is actually in the business of matching up landowners with those who may wish to purchase carbon storage credits. His company is called American Envirotech, and his name is Dr. Phil Combs. Welcome, Dr. Combs.
Thank you, Hayes.
I just wanted to give you a chance to talk about your experience in marketing these carbon credits that Jim was talking about.
Okay, thanks a lot. We've assembled a team of professionals that have a background in the area of carbon credits, and over the last few years we've been successful, or the team has been successful, in participating in about $25 million worth of credit sales. And presently, we're involved in assembling some sales, both domestically and internationally, that will be at least $5 million worth of sales, and we're working with private landowners to sequester their carbon on forest lands.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about how a person goes about proving that they have carbon and verifying to the person who wants to buy it that it's actually what they want to buy?
Well, what they would do would be to contact us, and we will send our team of professionals in the field, and we'll verify what they have growing. If they have growing trees, then we would do the testing of the particular tract of land, both soil, litter, and the trees, to determine the actual sequestration that's occurring on their tract of land throughout the land to get to some random sampling. Mm-hmm. Or if they have not planted the trees, then we would determine what they could sequester over a period of time.
I was wondering if there's an investment required in order to receive a payoff, and what the payoff might be expected to be.
Okay. It costs about $25 an acre to get signed up with us, and what that entails is there's about $2.50 that's used to list that there's carbon credits, and this takes care of the administrative costs, mm-hmm. and the notification to carbon traders of those carbon credits.
Mm-hmm.
About $10 of that $25 is used for the actual data collection in the field of gathering soil and all of the field data acquisition. And then $12.50 of that is used for analysis of the data and registration in an international registry, mm-hmm. where that we want to assure that all of our carbon credits are transparent, in that anyone could see and know that they are documented and that there's no question to the validity of those carbon credits.
Right. And what's the potential payoff for something like that?
We're estimating between 600 and 1,000 per acre over, say, a 70-year period. It's really difficult to say because of the variability in the market.
Okay.
But somewhere as much as $1,000 an acre for growing trees.
And we're on the cusp of this whole market, I think, right now, aren't we? There's the data that we have to go on what the value of the thing is. Is it very well developed at this point?
Well, that's right. We're just on the leading edge of it. The Europe has been a little ahead of us. They've sold some credits. Some of the other countries have ratified the Kyoto Protocol. Canada ratified in December, and it's becoming very active.
One last question real quickly. Are there any restrictions? Can you do normal silviculture operations during the 70-year period?
For the most part, not just normal silvicultural practices are restricted. The only restriction would be that you can't do a clear cut, which has been common in the past. But what you would need to do is to leave about 30 to 35 mature trees and then plant back, and just maintain a diverse forest floor.
Okay, normal silviculture is permitted, but clear cut would be something that you would not do at the end of this.
That's correct.
Okay,
that's correct.
Gotcha. Thanks, Dr. Combs.
Sure.
Appreciate you joining
okay.
us. Joining us from the state capitol is Boyd Kelly, who's a lobbyist for the Alabama Forestry Association. Hello, Boyd.
Hello, Hayes.
Boyd, there's some interest, I think, in the legislature with providing rural landowners with protection against what's called nuisance suits. Tell us how this sort of thing relates to forest owners.
Well, there's an increasing amount of friction between folks who are used to living in the cities and suburban areas and those of us who live in rural areas. People from urban backgrounds aren't accustomed to the sights, sounds, and smells associated with rural activities like farming, ranching, and forestry. You may wonder how forestry fits in. There's a situation right now where a landowner cut his timber, leaving a neighbor no longer living in the woods, so to speak. Both the Department of Environmental Management and the Alabama Forestry Commission inspected the operation and determined that the only impact on the neighbor was to the view from his porch.
Okay, and he considered that a nuisance. The landowner did, I guess.
He did, and he is considering a nuisance lawsuit. Mm-hmm. And if we believe that if enacted, there's a loser pay provision in this bill that would that if he's unsuccessful, the person who brings the suit would have to pay the defendant's cost. And we think that that would cause that neighbor to perhaps rethink his plans to file this lawsuit.
Okay. Another issue I'd heard about relates to ADEM, the Alabama Department of Environmental Management, and I think the board that oversees that is governed by one at-large member, but there's some interest in having that position changed to someone who has a background in agriculture or forestry. How's that going?
Well, the bill originally was introduced, as you stated. Some members of the bill came to the floor last week. Some members of the legislature objected to replacing the at-large appointee with a representative of agriculture and forestry. Mm-hmm. There were some others that thought the reference to having a background in agriculture or forestry was a little too general and subjective. As a compromise, our side has offered to keep the at-large position and to define the agriculture and forestry position in more specific terms. Mm-hmm. The bill was carried over, but it'll probably be brought back to the floor when this agreement's put into writing. The new criteria for the forestry and agriculture appointment will probably reference some specific education requirements for the new appointees.
Okay. And finally, real quickly, there's a pressure to meet a budget shortfall in Montgomery. Are the legislators looking to forest land to help close this gap?
Well, some of them certainly are. The governor intends to call a special session here in 2 or 3 weeks to address this issue. It's debatable whether new taxes are needed to balance the budget. Many people think that elimination of waste and corruption with some sensible consolidation and other cost cutting would eliminate the need for revenue. But if tax increases are inevitable, my organization will work to ensure forest owners are not singled out. Any increase in property taxes on forest land must meet three criteria as far as we're concerned. Current use valuation must be maintained. There should be no discrimination based on who owns the land or the amount of acreage involved. And lastly, forest land must remain in the same classification as homes.
Okay. Thanks, Boyd. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
Bill Siegel is a nationally recognized expert in timber taxation, and he's with us to talk about a bill which is pending before the U.S. Congress that deals with how you write off your reforestation expenses. Welcome, Bill.
Morning, Hayes.
Bill, let me see if I first understand where we are now on this topic. As I understand it currently, timber investors can write off $10,000 of reforestation expenses over really what amounts to 8 years. Is that right?
That's so right. A maximum of $10,000 per year.
Okay. Now, and you'd like to see these written off all in 1 year, and you proposed a bill to do, and a bill actually has been proposed to do just that. I think it's called the Reforestation Tax Act or the Dunn Bill.
That's exactly right, Hayes, and actually the reforestation costs are only part of that bill. There are other parts that pertain to capital gains taxation, but the part that we want to talk about this morning is essentially the reforestation part.
Okay, you see a problem with the bill that's currently written because in order to qualify to write off these expenses in the way that you suggest, you have to be an active manager. Is that right?
That's correct, Hayes. Yeah, the bill would allow direct expensing of all reforestation costs, but the passive loss rules would prohibit some forest landowners from expensing those costs. So that's the problem with the bill as it's presently written. And but let me say, too, Hayes, that this is a bill that's been put together by forest industry in conjunction with Representative Dunn. But I'm with the Forest Landowners Tax Council, which represents non-industrial private owners, and of course, the problem with the bill that I've just talked about would directly impact some non-industrial owners.
Mm-hmm. I guess whatever an active manager is, it's pretty obvious that the forest industry does practice active management, but for the private non-industrial forest landowners, the way the tax rules are written, they sometimes don't even qualify for that.
That's exactly right, Hayes.
Well, is there a dollar limit that is can it be expensed every year as the current bill is?
The current bill would have no dollar limit. It would be all reforestation costs regardless of amount.
Okay.
That could be directly expensed.
Well, the amounts haven't been adjusted very much recently despite all the increase in costs that we're seeing.
Well, that's right. The $10,000 cap on amortization under current law is the same cap that was put in place when that provision was put into law in 1980. And it's never been raised.
Tell me what group you're working with to promote this particular modification in the Reforestation Tax Act.
All right, well, our Forest Landowners Tax Council, which, as I've said, is the organization representing the tax interests of non-industrial owners, is working with the American Forest and Paper Association's Tax Council to amend the Dunn bill to allow all reforestation costs, but even by those owners who would not otherwise be eligible under the passive loss rules, to directly expense those costs. In other words, we want an exception in the bill to provide those owners who would be otherwise prohibited by the passive loss rules from expensing reforestation costs to be able to do so.
Okay, and I think you told me yesterday you were actually drafting the language to make those
that's
changes.
That's right. I drafted some language yesterday in conjunction with the Tax Council of AFMPA, the American Forest and Paper Association, and I believe that chances are very good that that amendment will be able to be put into the Dunn bill.
Okay, thank you, Bill, for your work on behalf of non-industrial private landowners.
Thank you, Hayes.
Well, for those that grow pine trees, the conventional wisdom is to clear cut and plant even age stands. This means that all your trees were regenerated on the same day. But that wasn't always the conventional wisdom, and for the Crossett Experimental Forest, they do things a different way. They practiced uneven age management. Ernest Lovett is a forester for the Crossett Environmental Forest, and he's with us. Hello, Ernest.
Good morning.
Ernest, why don't you just tell us a little bit about what the Crossett Forest is all about?
Well, it's a U.S. Forest Service experimental forest. It was established in 1934 in South Arkansas. It's the only Forest Service land for 100 miles around here, but its mission when it was established was to develop and evaluate low-cost silvicultural techniques and management alternatives for naturally regenerated stands, and the target audience is the private non-industrial timberland owner.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about showcasing your experiments there and the work that you're doing in this slightly unconventional method of regeneration?
Well, it's the forest is laid off, and they were pretty wise back in 1934 when Russ Reynolds first started this forest. He laid off 40-acre blocks, and each one of them is a compartment in individual experiments. And probably, and we've got good Forest Service roads paid for by taxpayer money. It's very accessible. Probably the two premier experiments on the forest are the Good Farm 40 and the Poor Farm 40. And this land was actually donated by the old Crossett Company, which later became Georgia Pacific, to help them out with some in their management problems. Most of the land was cut over in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And so the Poor Farm 40 experiment took an understock stand and actually built growing stock, regenerated, and showed that you can grow over a 40 to 50 year rotation, you can average 300 board feet per acre per year.
Now, is this can people come and see this, and do you have any particular events that are coming up?
Yes, it's open all year round. Welcome visitors, and show them our experiments. We have some good publications here. In fact, one is we hand out. We hand out a couple of them. We have them here, but we can also get other publications. But our annual field day that is coming up May 13th, and that's where we actually take people out in buses and tour and get out in the woods and show them on the ground the experiments. And this year we're adding a little newer twist to it. We're trying to show the non-industrial landowner the newer technology that's more consumer-based now. GIS and GPS now it's got real user-friendly. And we're trying to show them how this technology can help them manage their forest.
Okay, that's the Crossett Forestry Field Day on May 13th. Thanks, Ernest. Well, if you manage for uneven age stands like they do at the Crossett Forest, you probably have developed a fairly well thought out forest management plan. Our next guest is with the Alabama Forestry Commission. His name is Jim Jeter, and we'd like to ask him about these plans. Hello, Jim.
Hello. How are y'all today?
Good. I just wanted to ask you about these plans. Do you, you know, I've heard some people say it's really not even necessary to have a plan, but what's your view on that?
Well, hey, as you've heard every speaker prior to me, that to use an old cliche, this is, you know, land management is not your father's Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about very technical aspects of forest management, and the prudent land manager of the day will absolutely need a written management plan for various reasons. Whether it be record keeping, inventory, and a plan of where he wants to go from this point, guidance, giving him technical information on that, support, if he were to have problems with IRS, a good written management plan with good documentation gives you good support on that. You know, you have good maps that give you, technical information about your boundary lines, problem areas, things of that nature. And, of course, if, in fact, certification goes full steam ahead, then, you know, one of the main requirements to meet certification under SFI is a written management plan. So it's going to be a part of prudent land management that a written management plan be developed for a piece of property.
Mm-hmm. And that does provide a paper trail for what you're doing and to compare what you actually did with what you intended to do, I guess.
Correct. And, you know, used to, many years ago, it'd just be when you needed a little money, you'd go out there and cut 10 acres or 15 or 20 acres. And, of course, you know, there's no way to tell for the landowner. He just took what he could get. And, you know, this day and time with the genetic improvement of seedlings, everything that's going on technologically wise, you may be losing money if you cut one stand versus another stand. So it's very important to have this laid out in the direction that you want to go.
You can get plans from several sources, I suppose. Consultants provide these and even the Forestry Commission. Does it matter what source these plans come from?
Well, the main thing, Hayes, I would say in that aspect is there's two differences between the Forestry Commission plans and consultant plans. One is due to conflict of interest. The state will not, since we're a service organization, allow us to give definite volumes, specific volumes dealing with a stand of timber. However, they are good management plans that give direction. Most consultants, if they do a good job on the plan, they're going to give you specific volumes dealing with those stands. So you can go ahead and you know, process a timber sale by those volumes. The main thing that is most important that I see people not happy with is they just pick any consultant. The consultant may or may not work toward the landowner's objectives, then they're dissatisfied. So when you're picking a consultant forester or someone with a forestry commission, the landowner needs to pick someone they can work with that's going to work with them. No different than a doctor you don't like or a lawyer you don't like.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thanks, Jim. We appreciate you joining us. Well, your management plan is addressed to your management team, and in the case of forest land, that's often made up of the same people you see around your Thanksgiving dinner table, or at least hope to. Our next guest is a co-author of a book called Making Sibling Teams Work, The Next Generation. He's Drew Mendoza. Welcome, Drew.
Well, thank you. Good morning.
Drew, if your management team is composed of brothers and sisters, do you see any advantages to something like that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And let me tell you what those are. First of all, you know, siblings, if they're working well together, can have a deep trust for one another.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they grew up together.
Mm-hmm.
So they also bring to the table, no pun intended, an intuitive understanding of one another, and in most cases, a sense of shared values. Put those three things together, and you've got a competitive advantage in the marketplace because you've got owners who trust one another, who understand one another intuitively, and, you know, who are committed to a future together, and oftentimes a shared vision.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about some of the, what's the flip side of that? Are there any problems?
Of course that there are. For one, we know it's going to take more time. You know, if you're going to be in business with a sibling, we know you're going to have to punish yourselves and go out and play some golf together or go bowling or sailing, but you need to do something that's fun. We also know, in terms of a potential downside, that if the sibling team is doing their job really well, and I don't mean for this to sound as divisive as it may, however, we do know that they need to create themselves to be a cohesive, unified team, and the more they become unified, the more alienated the parental generation is going to feel, because the kids are going to become less reliant on the parents, and that's going to be threatening to the parents. We find that what usually derails these guys and women is poorly crafted shareholder agreements, poor planning for liquidity needs, and sometimes a very strong parent who has maintained the peace and made the tough decisions over the years, you know, finally dies at the age of 80 or 85 or 90, and shortly after that parent's death, we see frequently these relationships fall apart because they were so reliant on the founder, and the next generation siblings never took the time to basically make the operation their own.
Okay, those are some of the advantages and disadvantages of sibling teams. In your book, I think it's called Making Sibling Teams Work, The Next Generation. Thanks, Drew.
You're very welcome. And by the way, that book's available on a link through your website or directly at our website, which is www.efamilybusiness, all one word, efamilybusiness.com.
Okay, very good. Our final guest is Tom Harris from Timbermart South. Welcome back, Tom.
Thank you, Hayes. Good to be here.
Tom, you've recently published a compilation of the average stumpage prices. What are you seeing?
Well, we've got some good news for the last two quarters, actually. We've had price improvement in all of the major products. Big story has been the pulpwood prices for both hardwood and pine have improved significantly over the last two quarters. But price improvements have been across the board, so mostly due to wet weather, but it is some good news for a change.
Now, are you speaking of what geographic area? Are you talking about the South in general, or do you have any does Alabama reflect the same type trend?
I was speaking of Alabama. It's been strong, and Alabama has higher prices than most of the South, and showed a strong recovery during the first quarter and also the fourth quarter of last year.
Okay. We heard recently, just anecdotally from someone in a part of North Alabama, that he's seeing hardwood pulpwood the highest it's ever been, you know, ever. And I wondered if your data can confirm those anecdotal stories that you hear.
Our data supports that, and that's true in Alabama. I think Southwide, it's almost a tie with peak prices earlier. And in real terms, after taking out inflation, it's certainly at the highest levels we've seen.
Okay. Well, we're glad to hear some good news, Tom, from you. Thank you for joining us. Well, that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Jim Cathcart, Phil Combs, Boyd Kelly, and Bill Siegel. And also, we appreciate the contributions of Ernest Lovett, Jim Jeter, Drew Mendoza, and Tom Harris. More and more, it's becoming apparent to policymakers that forests are part of the solution to some of our most pressing environmental problems. Soil conservation has been helped tremendously by reforestation, and now the problem of too much CO2 in the atmosphere is being helped by maintaining healthy, vigorous forests. Your forest is not only a bit of good news to your family, to your neighbors and even to your government, but it might also be a way of generating income from an unlikely source, those that are concerned about global warming and the greenhouse effect. But this will only come true for those who possess the entrepreneurial insight to take advantage of the opportunities that lie just over the horizon. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.